But was it going to be all right as the Beatles take Revolution into a whole new era from that point of view? Last week, we looked at the world of pop art. We addressed the American-style consumerism that was effectively emerging across the globe in many ways. And we looked at Britain's part in terms of addressing that and so on. This week, well, it's after the Summer of Love of 1967. The tune-in, turn-on, drop-out mentality that was there. And more young people in London were indeed dropping out of the consumer society. Partly as a protest against Vietnam, partly against the worlds that they found themselves in. And there were protests against the war in Vietnam in Europe as well, as we mentioned. Most notably in Paris. Hence the subtitle for this particular revolutionary aspect, the protest movement of London and Paris, 1968. Now, French students had traditionally been politically active. Why? Well, conditions in schools and universities were generally quite poor. There was classic cases of sexual repression through having to live in single-sex dormitories. So you had segregation from that point of view. And many French students would actually have fairly strong anti-bourgeois and indeed anti-university ideas. You see by these French protesters outside the Sorbonne in 1968. The expansion of universities in Britain, which had taken place during the 1950s and 60s, was to a certain extent being replicated in France as well, our nearest neighbours, of course. And in France, which obviously had been occupied by the Germans in the Second World War, many campuses were basically wastelands with no libraries, no facilities, and so on. Hence these early 1960s demonstrations at the Sorbonne in Paris, demonstrating for more staff, better lecture halls, and better facilities. France responded by basically sending in about 4,000 police to actually deal with this, and students would then resort to a strike. Protests would be continuing on and off over a number of sort of key things during this whole period. As you may recall, back in the day of Vietnam, which was formerly part of the French colony of Indochina, there was still a sense of French concern about Indochina. This had been a colony of France. It was part of the French Empire as opposed to the British Empire. And accordingly, it was also the site of a French defeat. So our nearest neighbours here, in terms of that side of things, are very much in a state of flux. And in 1968, everything blew up, it would seem. Not only did we actually have the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia to obviously restore order and so on, we still had Vietnam that was working through the whole processes. And in France, literally just an hour or so away from mainland Britain, students were worried about student repression. There was also fears that the French government were about to limit university entrances. And they were also concerned about major setbacks in Vietnam, which was bubbling under as well. At the same time as obviously we have issues relating to the civil rights movement, the liberation movement, and so on and so forth. And that kind of apparent change that we'd seen in the 1960s could conceivably have actually gone any number of ways in terms of where the thing was going to develop. On the 22nd of March in 1968, there was a protest movement in which all of those issues, the bomb, Vietnam, liberation and so on, student demonstrations were all brought together under the banner of what was referred to as an anti-capitalism protest. This was an opportunity for students to air their grievances about the Vietnam War, and it actually started as protests primarily against that Vietnam War. Now, over Easter 1968, the government started to restrict the entrances to universities. They didn't want to have universal education for all, so they started restricting the entrance to universities. And again, there were demonstrations in the Sorbonne. The police were invited in, and they actually asked students, as you can see here, to leave quietly. Mostly they agreed, but then they were bundled off into police vans. Other militants, other sympathisers who had a different ideological viewpoint, would actually rouse passers-by to action, and they'd put up small brick-like paving stones and start hurling them at police. They start attacking the police, and obviously these things escalate, and the police started attacking with tear gas and riot details, truncheons, and so on. The kind of figures we're getting over this Easter protest in 1968 were that 80 policemen and hundreds of students and onlookers were injured, and there were nearly 600 arrests. So it's quite a significant moment, which again clearly is being reported in the media and is seen as problematic. Remember, this is 40 years approximately since the Russian Revolution, which overthrew the monarchy in Russia and effectively led to the communist ideology being established there. Here is a situation where explicit communism are looking to kind of do the same with respect to France, etc. Concerns obviously being raised. On the 10th and 11th of May 1968, barricades started appearing in the student quarter in Paris. And those barricades basically sort of led to not quite no-go zones, but nearly, if you weren't a student. Students would take over the area, and they demanded the release of fellow protesters and the reopening of the Paris University, Sorbonne. Determined to keep police out of the area, those barricades involved, as you can see here, the overturning of cars and robbing building sites to provide general rubble to actually provide that whole system. And some young builders actually joined the students who were armed with paving stones and, of course, that well-worn anarchist fallback, the Molotov cocktail, which is kind of like taking a nice bit of petrol, a bit of a fuse, hurling it in, and before you know where you have it, it's almost like seeing a devastation of Frickley Athletic. The police actually launched an attack with grenade guns. There were stun grenades, there were gas grenades. All of this was mounting fairly rapidly into what was a fairly robust demonstration. The students were given food and water and refuge by the local residents. But the police action was fairly brutal. They attacked the wounded, they broke into private flats to drag students out, they arrested the residents. All, you might well say, excessive force. Very un-British, really, what's happening in France, but still a concern. You cast your mind back to the notion of the Napoleonic Wars and the French Revolution. There's always a concern in Britain in terms of revolutions that take place with our near neighbours, etc. Will there be a kind of contamination? Will things cross over? Will there be issues with respect to this? And this is a case of where you're certainly seeing civil uprising, civil concerns. Arguably, there were similar scenes to a certain extent with the Gilets protests this century and the lines from that point of view where people were concerned about conditions, but maybe not quite to the extent that we saw within this sort of instance. Over 2 days, that 10th and 11th of May, there were over 30,000 demonstrators, and French trade union leaders actually called for a general strike on the 13th of May, which was supported generally by about 30 to 40% of the population. That general strike was followed by a series of almost continuous strikes throughout the whole 1968 period. There were parades, there were demonstrations, there were sit-ins in theatres and cinemas and factories all over France. And broadly speaking, ordinary life... Get those French students out of there! It's all right, we're just rehearsing dramas. Ordinary life would come to a standstill. The students in Paris would go back behind the barricades. They cut down trees, they damage buildings, they engage in situations with the police and so on. Tempers were running high. And then to compound things, broadcasting in France actually closed down. It closed down for a 5-week period because they felt with respect to that whole civil unrest, there was no way in which they could actually report it effectively. So the only news that people were getting because of the complete shutdown of the media, or the broadcast media, was basically through the print, etc. This was the moment when maybe people felt, this is it. This is the moment of revolution. This is the time where all of our previously held thoughts about an egalitarian society, an equal society, dare I say, a communist society, would actually work, and bourgeois society and capitalism would basically just collapse. But it didn't. Probably for some very fundamental reasons. These were students in the main who were protesting. And students, broadly, have parents. Their parents were worried about student exams. That's the first sort of chilly situation that you've actually got, or first challenging scenario, where you have parental input in terms of that. And those alliances between the young workers and the students and so on gradually began to fall apart, because actually the protesters all wanted different things. The reason we introduced the piece with respect to the Beatles and Revolution is that John Lennon's song Revolution is very much all about that. It's focusing on the whole essence of wanting to change the world in an ironic sense, and again looking for how that was developed, how that was addressed, and so on. John Lennon at this stage is gradually beginning to build a kind of profile as a political commentator. Certainly his relationship with Yoko Ono is kind of one of those aspects, etc. But even the song Revolution attracted criticism, because actually it wasn't for one thing or another. It wasn't supporting communism, it wasn't supporting violence, it was simply stating the matter as it was. And Lennon in this particular time, pretty much at the height of the Beatles' kind of global cultural dominance, was very much seen as the democratic, peaceful consumer. Revolutions ultimately didn't help anybody. And he was proved right. And as we said, it fizzled out. The song that he wrote for the Youth International Movement in America, Come Together, puzzled the American protesters. And it's classic Lennon. It expresses lots of misgivings about the motives of the protest leaders and the violence that they're causing. It's interesting, a quote from Lennon at the time was, "If everyone demanded peace instead of another television set, then there'd be peace." So the balance between consumerism and where you're actually looking for in this crazy world that we're existing in. Teachers who were working on this period in countries where the students didn't actually have English as the first language often said that it was impossible to convey that tongue-in-cheek pragmatism. There was a translation difficulty, you know, in terms of how that was developing. And even Lennon said when the Beatles split up at the end of the 60s, he didn't understand why girls were crying and screaming in the streets, saying basically it was only a band splitting up. It's not as though anybody had died. So what was happening in Britain in 1968 in a similar period? Well, not very much, really. The Beatles were beginning to break up, with various members leaving for various periods and so on. George Harrison, obviously, is heading off to India for the Maharishi Transcendental Meditation course and so on. And there were sort of changes occurring from that perspective, but life, by and large, was kind of continuing. British students were broadly fairly docile. The British police didn't carry guns. Might be one of the reasons, so they weren't likely to immediately trigger off activities with respect to that. And those students who were politically active tended to turn to movements like the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, run by Bruce Kent. There were large numbers who'd wear the CND badge, and they'd go on marches led by pacifists like the mathematical philosopher Bertrand Russell. But even that was beginning to feel old-fashioned. I mean, the height of protests against the atom bomb was pretty much the 1950s, 58, 60s, early 60s, etc. And there was this sense, well, you know, we're still sort of here, we'll work through that. There were a number of student occupations, there were a number of student demands for student rights and so on, but generally those things would get sorted out without too much trouble. Actually, in Britain, there were very little support for student radicals. I mean, we have an image here of Mao Zedong and the lines that are coming through from that basis in terms of other areas. But as I say, with respect to CND, there's March 1961 and the Hiroshima vigil, etc. All very polite, very solid, very British in many ways in terms of the issues relating to that whole protest. The vast majority of British students were generally seen as not being radical. And if there was any characteristic that could be applied in general, it was probably in the word apathy. No change there, then, you might say. Is everybody getting together for the grand photograph of the LSJ on Monday? Whatever. Okay. There were grievances among students. Some students were disillusioned with the Harold Wilson government. They felt that this white heat government hadn't quite delivered in certain areas, hadn't quite delivered what it had promised and so on. And certainly there was a reluctance to actually support in any way, shape or form the war in Vietnam. But at the same time, the Labour government's refusal to actually deal with the clearly racist Ian Smith regime in Rhodesia and white minority rule in Rhodesia, now of course known as Zimbabwe, was seen as big problematic issues. And they were also seen as well as living in a country which had quite clearly racist immigration rules. There was also a lack of student representation in university and college management, etc. In fact, the Vietnam Solidarity Campaign received some support with teach-ins, where you actually just sort of actually just get in, you talk to the whole thing, at the London School of Economics and at Oxford. Now, at the same time, when student protest was becoming a big thing in 1968, in America, as we saw, obviously, we had big protests on student campuses, etc., in Europe, even in the Soviet Union and Japan, etc., what was happening in Britain kind of look quaint by comparison. You know, here we are, we strike for justice. Looks as though he's on a bit of a jolly, perhaps, you know, he's there from that point of view. And student opinion matters, you know, it's all a bit of a lark in many ways, really. It's very British. Or at least white, middle class British. I think it's worth addressing that particular area. Why? Well, unlike Paris or unlike French situations, the one thing that British students were experiencing were good student conditions. You know, this was a case of where, broadly speaking, conditions for students were already good. So there's no need to protest against, you know, single-sex dormitories or all sorts of other challenges in terms of accommodation, teaching, lack of staff, etc. And as a result of that, there was little or no violence. There were sporadic protests. And as we've mentioned, the British Empire and race were certainly issues that were not going to go away. You know, kind of like a sort of layers of an onion rolled into a whole number of key things from that point of view. Students would also sometimes protest against speakers that they connected with imperialism and fascism. Enoch Powell, for instance, remember him? Attracted demonstrators every time he spoke on a university platform, quite clearly because of his anti-immigration views and very borderline racist views as well. In the period 1966 and 1967, there were some major protests at the London School of Economics over the appointment of a new white director from Rhodesia called Dr. Walter Adams, who was supposed to have had links with the oppressive white minority government. There was a series of occupations and marches, but ultimately, Walters took up his post, and so, effectively, the protest didn't really secure what it was meant to secure in the first place. Now, in the summer of 1968, there was a small minority also at the London School of Economics. There's the view of them sort of outside the whole notion of the reference to, obviously, the character of Walter Adams, which is Adams closed it, we opened it, Vietnam to a victory to Vietnamese revolution, etc. There was a protest which kind of recognised what was happening in Paris, and there was an encouragement of that sign that actually if Paris can do it, we can do it in Britain as well. And that did include a launch of a revolutionary society. In October, the London School of Economics students, LSE, produced from the Students' Union a motion to occupy the school itself. Again, in support of the Vietnam Solidarity Campaign, later that month when a march was actually due. Now, on the weekend of March 1968, 800 students turned up, occupied the building, and turned it into a march HQ. Again, significant, worth reporting, but not hugely problematic in the whole scheme of things. Vietnam was clearly important. It was important everywhere else as well. If you're looking at one war, other than actually what was also bubbling through towards the back end of the 60s and led into the 70s and 80s, which was the troubles in Northern Ireland, arguably our own little civil war happening on our doorstep with respect to what's taking place in Ireland. But Vietnam's still seen as a very important aspect. Although the general public were not generally interested in student grievances, why would they? Students were seen as broadly work shy. You know, you go off to university, 3 years, you know, grants paid for, hopeless. But there was a sense that there was a more cohesive overview of support against the Vietnam War. People would take that seriously, and it did create a connection between fairly diverse groups, people who would actually campaign for different things, that kind of alliance we've spoken of before between women's rights, gay rights, civil rights, and so on and so forth. Certainly getting the Americans out of Vietnam was something that began to transcend divisions. So that was seen as a collective common cause. And in October 1967, obviously a year before the whole thing, and leading on to March 1968, which we've got an image of there, there was an anti-war protest outside the American embassy in Grosvenor Square. Now, this is significant, because remember, after the Suez Crisis, we have a situation whereby Britain can't do anything in terms of foreign policy other than support, quite slavishly, what's going on in the United States of America. So for students to effectively start occupying the United States embassy is problematic, particularly when you get 10,000 students turning up to actually engage with that process. You know, at that stage, not even Lyndon Johnson or the incoming President Nixon can actually say, we have not got a problem on that sort of basis. In March 1968, a second demonstration attracted more than double the number, with 25,000 students protesting at the embassy. And that demonstration started turning violent. There was fighting between protesters and police, which went on for about 2 hours. 145 police were injured, and many of the injured demonstrators were helped away by friends in order to avoid arrests, with 45 actually being treated at the scene of the incursion and so on. So just in a sense, as is occurring in terms of Paris, or would go on in occurring in Paris, you're getting these bubblings up, these fermentations of anger and angst from the generation which probably are kind of slotting into that baby boomer side of things, the people who've grown up within the 50s. Here we are at the end of the 60s, they're in the sort of late teenage, early 20s sort of area, etc. And again, obviously raising a number of key points. Led, of course, by a fairly famous individual in all sorts of ways, Tariq Ali. Tariq Ali was a former president of the Oxford Union. He was also very much the leader of what was seen as the radical left wing. He broadly at the time seemed intent on making threats of violence and, to be blunt, stirring things up. Really almost chasing a sort of anarchy within society and pushing for that, using all sorts of things. Something which politicians and other folk have kind of sometimes been notorious for doing for that particular aspect. There were stories in the press which would heighten people's fears, surprise, surprise, that Tariq Ali's team and demonstrators would be disrupting London, a bit like Extinction Agenda. They'd be attacking the American embassy, they'd be committing criminal damages, and so on and so forth. However, the left didn't succeed in this notion of hijacking the march, and the anti-Vietnam march effectively progressed fairly peacefully. There were about 100,000 protesters. So we'd gone in the space of a few months from 10,000 outside the embassy to 100,000. Again, numbers that you can't necessarily say are problematic in terms of the sort of scale of concern about America in Vietnam and so on. And of those 100,000 marchers, about 5,000 broke away from the main march route and headed for the American embassy, resulting in fights with police, which ended in about 40 arrests. But broadly, that's marginal in terms of managing the population and so on. Most of the protesters themselves were probably best described by the term peaceful idealists, something to come back to when we sort of consider the sort of notion of where this is going, the onset of peaceful protest, which was certainly put to test with respect to Martin Luther King in the 60s in Alabama, likewise with respect to Gandhi, arguably the way in which India finally effectively emerged as its own independent nation away from the British Empire was because of the peaceful protests of Gandhi and so on. Most of the protesters, as well as being peaceful idealists, were generally under the age of 24. They were educated, and about half of them were students. Effectively, at the march as well, they even joined with the police and actually sang Auld Lang Syne. Not these police, because that's another side of things. Research at the time suggested that of those 100,000 who were on the march, 96% were against Vietnam, 68% were against capitalism in general, 65% didn't like the structure of British society, and actually only 10% were prepared to get involved in any kind of violence whatsoever. Possibly, as some of the bother boys that we see there. And that, in Britain, was the height of the protest. Marches in 1969 were much smaller. They still took place, but they were much reduced in size. And in 1969, the London School of Economics authorities finally installed security gates, which the students promptly knocked down with sledgehammers, as they would. which resulted in the authorities taking sacking some lecturers and then locking the students out for 4 weeks. So a little bit of tit for tat, but nothing which was hugely sort of problematic on that basis. By then, in 69, any notion of social revolution and change had pretty much faded away. So the question needs to be put again, why was there so little radicalism in Britain in this particular period? And it is a fairly vexed question. Now, we've seen the Beatles were perhaps the icons of the age. And maybe, as some critics have actually said, because they were mostly interested primarily in popular art, pop art, consumerism and peace, there wasn't really a kind of notion to kind of stir people up to march on the barricades and so on. Also, as the 60s progressed, we see another incarnation, another entry in terms of what we probably best be considered communications or cultural subcultures. And of course, it's the classic hippie, the notion of the hippie culture, how that's evolving, the kind of cross-reference with respect to partly American, partly British, cross-fertilisation, fusions of ideas. And as the 60s progressed, there was this notion of many people would actually adopt the hippie persona without actually becoming hippies. So it was almost a kind of lifestyle choice for weekends. You know, you'd work in the city, you'd do your stuff there, you'd come back on weekends, you'd go off to an event, you'd be a hippie, and so on. Not too dissimilar, maybe, to people go to Glastonbury and various other sort of folk. Now, with respect to that hippie persona, many of the people who would become iconic within that field would be writing political protest songs like their contemporaries in America, people like Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. But whereas American protest songs at this period are very much anti-Vietnam, etc., the British counterparts tended to stay away from politics and they held very much to pop art and consumerist ideals. Ray Davies, for instance, of the Kinks, who was actually banned from America after a rowdy tour in 1965, was still writing about the Village Green Appreciation Society. The whole notion of how bands were being developed was looking at, shall we say, the trivial, the kind of the general sort of ephemera of life and so on. The hippies had actually arrived in London during the 1960s, but they were still very much an American phenomenon. So we're almost back at that notion of, here we are, another cultural thing which has kind of evolved and developed in the United States, which is suddenly transferring consciousness or transferring its sort of roots to Britain as well. Most hippies tended to group themselves around charismatic leaders. They would take psychedelic drugs to expand their consciousness. Fairly mistaken idea, as we latterly found out, causing psychoses and all sorts of other areas, etc. They tended to live in communes, and they practiced fairly free sex. They were also self-declared pacifists, so flower power, the earth, the natural world would triumph. We're also seeing at this stage the growth of the ecological movement. Writers like Frank Herbert in the novel Dune, who he dedicated to the planetary ecologists and so on. This sense of the climate is changing and so on, which obviously is very much at the forefront of our thoughts and concepts now, was gradually sort of taking root, no pun intended, in terms of this way of being beyond just tree huggers, but believing that the notion of one world, one environment was important to acknowledge, etc. There was also a sense that ultimately the earth and the natural world, as James Lovelock would say, the Gaia hypothesis, which he coined in the 1970s, would actually triumph. That no matter what we kind of did as human beings during our 70 years, or however long we have as a lifespan on the planet, actually it wouldn't make much difference in the end of the day. Things would sort of work out and pan out, you know, whatever will be. Nothing is real, and so on. Certainly hippies would wear distinctive clothing. They had their own brand of distinctive music, and they were into Oriental mysticism, meditation, Indian clothing, long hair, beads, incense, and of course peace symbols. In 1966, George Harrison travelled to India, as I mentioned, to basically under the auspices of the guru Maharishi Yogi from that point of view. But again, we're still seeing in society the impact of hippies being quite limited. although again, we know of them, we know where they come together, Syd Barrett and Pink Floyd, obviously key to that sort of aspect. And in a way, hippies could be defined as idealists. They were seeking a simpler, kinder, less selfish world. And that inevitably colours the period. Sort of heads up for you, the theme of the NSS survey, where you can actually go to NSS Central, National Student Survey, if you're in your third year, second year, you have to wait. This year's theme is the 80s. Wow. Not the 80s of Thatcher destroying the health service, but the 80s of Wham! And so on. So if you see lots of people actually in 80s culture, you think, oh, that's like a throwback to the 80s. Ultimately, this notion that the world would change by itself, that people would all join communes, they'd give up their worldly goods, and that love and peace would triumph, maybe it was unrealistic, maybe it was naive. But while there were hippie communes in Britain, it was a fairly small-scale phenomenon. Far more people became what we refer to now as weekend hippies. They would buy the clothes, they would buy the music, they'd go to the clubs, they'd express some of the ideals about peace, and then they'd go back to work on Monday, working for the man. In other words, it's a part-time fashion statement, which you could say about a lot of musical genres, that you actually sort of just engage in it on cultural genres because it's fashionable for the day, but when all's said and done, you move back to life, etc. There were certainly a large number of shops that would cater to hippie styles. Military uniforms, oriental clothing, headbands and incense were all very quick to cash in on the burgeoning hippie market. Ironic when you bear in mind the original sort of hippie ideals and so on. And underground clubs began to appear where people could actually take drugs and watch psychedelic slideshows. This is again the notion where the psychedelic nature and the colour that sort of emerges begins to emerge. Hence Syd Barrett's Pink Floyd, who were probably the most famous bands to come out of that underground sequence. But this is a period also where recreational drug use quite simply gets out of control. Syd Barrett himself had actually left Pink Floyd by 1968, partly due to mental illness precipitated by heavy drug use. And everybody, in other words, seemed to be overdoing it. There was an excess there, maybe to literally just tune in, tune out, etc. As we mentioned when we were talking about the growth of the liberation movements, there were new magazines coming on stream, underground newspapers were coming on stream, Oz, of course, It in 1966, Oz in 1967. IT, the International Times, would focus very much on international issues. Oz, as you can see, was a bit more daring in terms of its subject matter, in terms of where it's actually looking through that whole process. The pornography of violence is the line there. Very crude by today's standards, pre-desktop publishing, but put together in a sort of way which kind of focused on international aspects. But it would look at subjects like paedophilia. It would look at sexual issues. It was, of course, as we'd already noted, also very chauvinistic in outlook. Women would be regularly described as sex objects and so on. And ultimately, the establishment themselves started becoming increasingly worried about breakdowns in social order. Next week, when I start talking about the growth of pirate radio and the brief flourishing of pirate radio before the establishment clamped down on it and said no more pirate radio, we'll see some of the sort of issues about that, where you're trying to deal with issues relating to repression, but also ways in which you actually are, on another level, simply feeding the capitalistic ever-growing appetite for purchasing, buying stuff, and so on and so forth. But that concern about breakdowns in social order, and again as seen in the Parisian riots of 1968, permissiveness, pornography, cultural experimentation and drug taking, all kind of impacts the whole sort of aspect of life and times. And in 1967, the Marine Offences Act, introduced by Anthony Wedgwood Benn of the Labour Party, gave the authorities power to close down the pirate radio stations, which had blossomed over a three-year period, very much playing popular music 24/7 with commercials, which was radical and extreme because up until that stage, the only radio you could listen to in Britain was the BBC. There was no commercial equivalent. Commercial radio did not start in Britain until the 1970s. The other offshoot of introducing the banning of pirate radio was to restructure the BBC, which of course launched Radio 1 in 1967, with Tony Blackburn being the first presenter, and the first particular piece of music that he played on Radio 1 was Flowers in the Rain. So, no change there then. By The Move, who were a band led by Roy Wood. Radio 1 was a pop music station, but it was safe, it was regulated. In other words, the moral control was very much back with the establishment. It wasn't a case of things getting out of hand and so on. February 1967, Mick Jagger, of course, again emblematic of this area, etc., and Keith Richards were both arrested and convicted of drug possession, something that was very much seen, at least publicly, as not to be tolerated at all. Who would have thought he'd get a knighthood several years later? There we are. Jagger eventually was freed on appeal, and he was given a suspended sentence. Now, at the same time as this is happening, certainly in terms of television, in terms of media and ways in which that's relating to the government, the National Viewers and Listeners Association, which was fronted by a lady called Mary Whitehouse, lobbied actively for an increase of censorship and a return to moral Christian values. So you've still got that tension between people who actually say modernity, post-modernity, moving forward, and those people say, but what about the Britain of our youth? What about the time where everybody knew their place, and so on and so forth? White House, together with Lord Longford, effectively prosecuted the editors of Oz magazine in 1971, and they were prosecuted on the basis of obscenity. They were found guilty, they then appealed, they won the appeal, but at the same time, the negative publicity resulted in the paper closing in 1973. So, what did the 1960s effectively achieve as a decade, as something which we've spent a number of weeks sort of looking at, perusing, etc., before we move into private radio and then sort of concluding sort of sequence? Well, in November 1969, the New Statesman magazine carried out a survey to discover what people thought about the 1960s, and it makes quite interesting reading. Although many people realised that there were lots of changes in the 60s, such as easier laws for homosexuals, divorce, abortion, etc., 5% actually said that they really didn't welcome change, but the most welcome change was better pensions, with 51% actually saying that better pensions was the biggest sort of improvement about the 60s. The least welcome changes of the decade were very much two clear areas that fit into a number of the essay titles as well. One was immigration, and the other one was student unrest. 77% of those surveyed also thought that there was far too much publicity given to sex. So, what did the 1960s countercultural movement achieve? Because we are talking about the counterculture and lines from this. Well, maybe we need to consider a quote from John Lennon to sort of wrap up with, in terms of, you know, where all these protests, all these hippies, all these elements actually worked through. And we'll wrap up actually with a John Lennon song, which perhaps also epitomises something which may be seen as either charmingly naive or very important or significant or still resonating. Lennon's quote was as follows: "The thing the 60s did was to show us the possibilities and the responsibility that we all had. It wasn't the answer, it just gave us a glimpse of the possibility of the answer. It wasn't the answer, it just gave us the glimpse of the possibility of the answer."